Good morning. Welcome to In and Around the House with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys. It's going to be a great day to get some stuff done in and around your house and your landscape and get your locally owned, independently operated garden center. And hopefully things have changed weather-wise just a little bit. It has been quite the roller coaster, hasn't it, Tony?
Well, that's what I understand. I've been out of town. You'll have to fill me in. I just got in yesterday. Yes.
Vacation again, huh? No, you're always on vacation. No, I'm not. The old boy says.
He probably does.
Yeah. Yep. It has been quite the roller coaster. We've had torrential downpours, thunder, lightning, heat, humidity. We have the whole experience the last couple of days.
Interesting. Yeah. Tina and I were in Atlanta. We were at the gift market and, just picking up some things for next spring, believe it or not.
I don't see my gift.
No. I don't have it with me. It's out in the car. How's that?
Yeah, that's it.
But I did have to call my dad one day to check on something. And, you know, he's like, oh, it's brutal here. It's brutal. It's hot. Hotter than you know.
Yeah.
A couple explicitives and it was funny. And I'm like, well, you know, Pop, I'm down here in Atlanta, hot Atlanta. It's just as hot here, too.
Right. Yep.
Oh, you know, just it's funny.
I can hear him.
Yeah, you know him. you know how he is.
Yeah.
So it's either it's too hot or it's too cold or you're too busy or not busy enough.
Yep.
But it's always funny to get his viewpoint on things. But I understand it was a little brutal, humid. And these are the type of things that you just mentioned, you know, when you have those kind of extremes, you know, those fluctuations with the temperatures, Ernie, as they rise and get hot and it gets humid. And then you have those days where you just have those downpours. That combination wreaks a lot of havoc. It plays hard on some of our shrubs and plants in the landscape. It really does.
It sure does. And hopefully we can get through the next couple of days. It's going to be okay, and then more rain on Monday. But today, look for a high around 83, partly sunny skies. A little bit warmer on Sunday, 86, but then rain returns on Monday. Lots of sunshine on Tuesday. So you got a chance to get out and get a couple of things done.
This morning, it's been a while since I've had the top off of my Jeep.
I noticed that when I came in this morning.
And as I was driving in, you know, I was like, whoa, it's a little chilly. So I turned the floor, you know, the heat on the floor just to get a little bit of warmth there. But the air just felt so good this morning. It was crisp. Kind of ironic to say, hey, you got the top down, but you put a little heat on. It's kind of goofy. But
like I see these people in convertibles that have the top down and all the windows up. I'll never understand that as long as I live.
In a parka.
Yeah.
I don't know, but it felt really nice. And it's been a long time since I've had the top down, believe it or not.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been over a year, actually, or so. And the other day I had it off. It was last week, and I just kept it down. I got caught in one of those rains. You know, it's like, oh, you got to be kidding me.
Yeah.
And then I'm sure people were thinking, look at that idiot.
Oh, well. Same way when I'm out on the bike, when you get caught in a storm like that or a shower, everyone wants to take the time to pull up next to you and wave.
Yeah, well, I don't think, you know, it's funny you say that because I don't think, you know, when I see a biker and you get caught in the rain, I don't think that is as goofy as somebody like me or someone with a convertible with the top down.
Right.
It's like, that's not right.
Hey, I want to tell you, we just absolutely love, we stopped down to Jackson's. We took our own advice at our house and went to our locally owned, independently operated garden center, as we suggest you always do. And the echinaceas, after we talked about it on the show last week, came down and picked up a couple for Lisa. And we got them in the ground. She loved them so much, she sent us back to get some more on Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
And they're absolutely brilliant.
And you brought little Gideon in with you. And cute kid. And I love the fact that you need to post that photograph, as a matter of fact.
I will.
I like that he's involved, he's engaged, and he had his gardening wagon.
He did. He insisted on bringing that down. And I'm not exaggerating. That was his idea. I said, you know, I asked him, I said, Gideon, we have to go get some flowers for... We're called Mamaw and Papaw with Gideon. And I said, we got to go get some flowers for Mamaw.
Mm-hmm.
I've got to take my wagon. So I said, okay. And I'll do that. I'll send to John, our producer, and have him post that so you can check out Gideon and his little wagon with the echinaceas. And what's so cute about young ones like that is what's on their mind comes out of their mouths. And every plant we walked by, hey, I think we need one of these. Hey, I think we need some of this. And the back of the garden center, we have the little ramp up there.
Yeah.
We went up there and saw your dad, the old boy, and he just was thrilled to see Gideon pulling that wagon around until Gideon got the idea.
He could ride it down a ramp?
He could just let it go and let it roll down the ramp.
Oh, okay. I thought he was going to hop in it and ride it down the ramp.
Well, having been around the block once or twice, I knew what was coming. So I stayed at the bottom of the ramp, and sure enough, he turned around and just let it go, and it was rolling toward that big pallet of ceramic pots. And that's when I said, well, our shopping experience is over. It's time to go on home. But it was neat. I'm going to send those to John. We'll get the pictures of Gideon posted up on our In and Around the House Facebook page, and you can check him out.
That that also reminded me of, it was the photograph that I posted on Facebook that a little girl had her own shopping cart.
That was
she
it.
She had the tomato plant in it and all that good stuff. Mm-hmm. So it's really cute to see kids and get them engaged and, you know, following in your footsteps when it comes to gardening, because really they are the future gardeners. We need to get them more engaged. We need to teach them and be their mentors when it comes to gardening. But you hit the nail on the head. Those echinaceas are stunning.
Mm-hmm.
Lots and lots of color with the echinaceas, a great pollinator. And we had even posted some of those Facebook pictures last week. I know that I think that it's on there. I haven't looked just recently. I have to verify this. There's a honeybee on one of those blooms.
Yeah.
So that told me in itself that somebody close by has a hive or it wasn't too far away.
Yeah. It's interesting that you say that, because when we got back to the house, we took the wagon out and the plants out and rolled them over and set them on the back patio so until we could get to them and get them in the ground. When we came back out, there was already bees visiting those echinaceas. So they apparently couldn't wait to get them in.
Oh, I love echinaceas. And this time of year, they are in their glory. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's really important when we talk about some of the plants now, even later on in the show, you have to hang out with us because we're going to talk about the hardy hibiscus. They are in their glory right now.
Right.
And, these are things that when you get out to your local garden centers and nurseries, the season's not over. I know a lot of people are on vacation, kids are out of school and all that good stuff, but now is the perfect opportunity for you to see what plants really look like and what you can expect them to do for you in the landscape or in the garden or whatever this time of year. Just getting out and seeing how they're performing at this point in time. That's huge.
Yeah, and I also have a question for you. I was coming, with the closures on the Brent Spence Bridge, traveling between Kentucky and Ohio has been quite the challenge. So I'm always trying to get a different route and a different way around. And I was trying to make my way back down from up north, up 71, and you want to avoid that all the way. So I came down through Madison Road and decided to come through Hyde Park. And it brought me down the hill to Columbia Parkway, and I saw some plants just as I got to the bottom where they have a decorated area that I want to ask you about. We'll post those pictures too so you can identify them for me. In and Around the House with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys, when we come back.
Well, we're going to touch base on that plant you're talking about as well. And also, maybe some things we need to start considering or thinking about when it comes to keeping the lawn looking at its best. A couple things are creeping in on us.
We'll be right back. Welcome back In and Around the House with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys. And I did send that picture to our producer, John. We'll get that up in just a few minutes. And then Gideon is up, and I'm going to send a couple of other pictures of some plants that I saw. But before we get to that, there is some stuff creeping into the lawn. And I have to admit that we are doing that too. We have some things creeping into the lawn that we've got to start battling.
Well, you made me think of this when you were talking about last week's roller coaster ride, with the high humidity, the temperatures, creeping upward, and just it was unbearable. And then all of a sudden you get those rains. Those are the type of situations, you know, when we talk about the weather combinations, that crabgrass loves that kind of weather.
Yeah.
It thrives in that kind of weather. And so does another one of our favorites, too, Nutsedge. You know, it thrives in that kind of weather. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Those high humidity levels and all that moisture, and everybody's all happy with these two guys. And when they get into the lawn, believe me, they get into the lawn. And I was telling you, I was out of town there for a couple of days, and as I was walking down the street to the mailbox, I'm not like you. We don't have our own mailbox right in front of the house. You know, we got this little...
What?
Yeah.
A group mailbox?
Yeah, it's a group mailbox.
I bet that's a real joy in the middle of winter.
I don't mind it. I'm okay with that. Anyway, I was walking down the street.
Just a point about that. I have some friends who were mail carriers and retired. I don't know. Does anybody send anything of importance in the snail mail anymore?
Bills. That's right. Important.
Enough said. Go on with the story.
Right?
Yeah.
That's the only thing I think it goes by mail still, or bills.
No wonder I don't go to the mailbox.
Yeah, there you are.
Go ahead.
Anyways, I was, you know, walking down the street. One of the yards, I was like, there's some good-looking crabgrass right there. I just, you know, it's starting to just really, you know, take off, you know, starting to get vigorous in this kind of weather.
Mm.
And so when you just touched base on today's temperatures being relatively decent, you know, what's really important when we go after some of these grassy types of weeds and so forth, or other broadleaf weeds in the lawn, temperature is really what it's all about.
Yep.
You know, in addition to good products, okay? But with the temperatures kind of settling down a little bit, you might want to take it upon yourself to stop by one of your local garden centers and nurseries, provided you don't already have something in your arsenal to go after some of this crabgrass. Mm-hmm. It's starting to just make way. You know, pick up Fertilume's Weed Out with Crabgrass Killer. Now, what I want to point out with this as well, it has a product in it. It's going to get rid of, you know, help you eliminate the crabgrass that's, you know, developing and growing in your lawn right now, or maybe perhaps in some of your landscape beds. But, you know, you might also still, I want you to know this, you might still find this on some store shelves, and you're only going to find this at your local garden centers and nurseries, where it might say Weed Out with Q. They're both identical products. You know, Fertilume changed the name, so now you're going to see it called Weed Out with Crabgrass Killer. Or you might find it in the old bottle. It says Weed Out with Q.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you want to pick up.
Okay.
Mix it accordingly. Okay. And I can't
read the direction.
Read the label. That's thank you, Ernie. Read the label. And more is not better. Keep that in mind. Think about this. When I say more is not better, it boils down to this. There's a lot of money and research that's put into some of these products from various companies. And believe me, think about this. If it calls for, I'm just going to throw this out as an example, a tablespoon to a gallon of water, don't put two and don't put three and think that's going to be better. The companies will do that for you just for the mere fact that hopefully you would go through the product quicker so you buy more.
Right.
It's to their advantage to do that. So what they're specifying that you use, stay with that recommendation. But go ahead and go after some of the crabgrass that might be creeping into your lawn. And we're also going to touch base on really another way to go after crabgrass. But right now, we need to take a post kind of approach to it. So when All we right. say post, it's already there. So we need to go after it that way. So look for a Fertilume's Weed Out with Crabgrass Killer. Now, what I like about this particular product for homeowners, you can buy it in three different formats. First and foremost, I gravitate towards the concentrates. And when we talk about the concentrates, those are the ones, you know, there's nothing fancy about it. You know, it's going to come in either a pint or a quart. In some cases, you might find things in gallons too, but, you'll mix those up accordingly and you'll have a tank sprayer that you're going to use to apply it with.
Mm-hmm.
Talking about the tank sprayers, make sure that you label those tank sprayers accordingly. So you know that, hey, this is for herbicides, or this is for fungicides, or this is for whatever. That's so important. A lot of times people will tell me, I had some product left over, I never cleaned it out, or, you know, had taken care of it properly. It was in a tank, and I thought it was this. And right. when I sprayed my shrub the other day, it just all withered up and turned brown.
Yeah.
So label your tank sprayers accordingly. But what I like about this product is I was mentioning.
Did you advise my wife, Lisa, to do this when she came to you a couple of weeks ago to pick up a few things? Because I noticed that she was using Kills All in one area that we reworked.
Uh-huh. And, I could have.
And she had written as big as you possibly can on the tank sprayer, Kills All.
And, you know, and when you, I'm glad you brought that up because what's really important to think about this, a lot of times we can get a residual from products and a little bit of that residual can still remain in that container if you I've don't often, wash it out yep. thoroughly.
Yep. I've often thought about that.
And therefore you could, you know, you might experience yep. a little bit of damage.
And, you know, that brings us to another point. If you're going to use some things to measure, that product with mm-hmm. to mix it,
mm-hmm.
I would keep that separate. In the shed, away from any other use.
Yeah, keep them out of the kitchen. Keep those measuring spoons out of the kitchen. That's what you're saying. I know exactly what you're saying.
Yeah.
And, you know, also a lot of garden centers and nurseries, we do at Jackson Florist and Garden Center, you know, we sell little measuring cups, or we even give you a measuring cup if you need one.
Right.
That's important. It's just for that, and you can kind of keep that, you know, with your arsenal all the time. But know what you're using. And two, those are important to keep clean as well.
Sure.
You need to clean those products. Mm-hmm. But going back to the way or the various, you know, formats that you can buy Fertilume's weed out with crabgrass killer, you know, I was just mentioning the concentrate. That is one way that you can pick it up at your local garden center or nursery. Secondly, you can also pick it up as an RTS, which is ready to spray.
I like that.
Which is a very convenient way to just simply take it, attach it to your hose end, and everything's pre-calibrated for you, and you just turn it on and you spray away. Now, a little tip when you use the RTS, the hose end products, is, you know, just make sure things are siphoning out like they should.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've had some issues in the past where, you know, sometimes they don't siphon correctly, but don't be under the false impression that they are. Just keep an eye on that product. There's a little window down the side of the RTS, the ready-to-spray bottle, that you can see it starting to work its way down.
Right, right.
Okay. If you've been out there spraying for 30 minutes and it's still at the top, something's wrong. Okay? So the RTS, you know, it's a really easy way to just apply the product. And secondly, if you just have a couple small spots, you know, maybe a couple in the landscape bed or out in the lawn, you know, it comes in an RTU. That's a ready-to-use spray applicator, just like a, you know, a bottle of Windex or something
sure.
like that.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
that makes it easy and just, you know, you can spray a couple different spots. And also keep in mind, what I like about this Fertilume product, the Weed Out with Crabgrass Killer, is that it is a selective herbicide, so there are no worries whatsoever that it's going to do any harm to the lawn. Now, it could, given, you know, when we're talking about temperatures, Ernie,
mm-hmm.
Keep that in mind. Once you get above 85 and you push 90, it's lights out. Don't apply these products because weeds aren't as, you know, they're not as apt to take the product in either. And what else is nice when you're using these products is to make sure, you know, water your lawn or you just had a nice rainfall prior to, you know, when everybody's happy, they've had a really good drink, these products work best.
Right, right.
And do not scalp the lawn and think you're going to apply these products and it makes it more effective as well. That's the furthest from the truth.
Right. You take away the target area if you do that.
You're lessening the surface area for the for the applied product to get onto the whatever it is that you're spraying, which makes it more effective.
749-B105 in and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys. We need to pause for a moment when we come back.
Another one that loves this high humidity weather that you guys were experiencing last week when I was out of town and all the moisture that you had. This is another one we're going to target and go after when we come back.
Welcome back in and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys. And Tony got an early morning question from Kim in Independence, my old hometown. Kim, what's going on with your hibiscus?
Hi. Yes, I really don't have a problem with them. I have some single hibiscus and some begonias, and I have maybe 18 of them. All together, they were beautiful. Got them maybe 2 weeks ago. I got them in South Carolina when we were on vacation.
Mm-hmm.
I had them gorgeous. I get up one morning, every one of them are beheaded, and they're pulled up from the from the, you know, from the root.
From the ground.
Every one of them.
You know, I'm a, do you live in an area where it's wooded, perhaps?
A little bit.
Any raccoon activity occasionally?
Yes, a lot. A lot of raccoons. I have a ton of raccoons. Do you think it was them?
I do.
Possibly a deer.
Well, you know, I'm not going to tell you that a deer couldn't bite into something or pull it up or uproot it, especially, you know, it was easily uprooted just for the mere fact that you just planted those. That's what made it a little bit easier for whoever the culprit is.
Mm-hmm. I just wondered if you thought maybe it was a raccoon or a deer.
I remember it was a few years ago, some of the perennials down in the backyard at where I live. They were just pulled out of the ground, totally just on their side and roots exposed.
Yep.
And I was just like beside myself. Thinking,
oh, I know. I'm devastated. They were gorgeous and big and beautiful. And now I have nothing but little tiny stems.
Oh, that's too bad. I think that's what it is because initially I thought I had a groundhog issue because I know groundhogs would do that too. So anyway, I set a good old have a heart trap down there, and I caught a big coon. Took him out to the SPCA, and they took care of the rest. And I never had that problem thereafter.
Again,
no,
I see them all the time. I mean, mm-hmm. They're always running around my yard. I see them all the time. So I thought that maybe what it was. So, I didn't know if they would eat plants like that or not.
Well, usually they're. They might sometimes eat on the roots, you know, and I'm sure you just brought those back from your trip, and you watered those in well, and it was a little dry, and hey, that's a source of water for some of those guys.
Wow.
I can almost bet, if I was going to the window to place a bet, win, place, or show, it would be on the coon.
On the coon. Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. So, all right, I just wondered. So I was beautiful. I had so many compliments on it. Now all I have is stems. It's so devastating, you know.
You know, Kim, was it the hibiscus that you brought back? Were they the hardy varieties, or were they the tropical varieties that you
tropical?
Took
it, tropical. They were tropical. Yep, just single plant. They were beautiful, all colors. We got them from. I found a plant place in South Carolina that I went to, and mm-hmm. they were just single plants. You know.
Wow.
And they were dark. They were beautiful.
Well, just give them an opportunity. You know, if you might be able to still salvage those, go ahead, mm-hmm. Pot them up or plant them, you know, plant them again and,
okay.
you know, give it a shot. You know, as long as the root's there, cut them back a little bit and see what happens. Yeah.
Okay.
And do us a favor, take some pictures and post them. We'd like to follow along and check out the progress.
All righty. Okay. Thanks a lot, Kim.
Have a good weekend. Bye, Kim.
All right.
Thanks, Kim. 749-B105, in and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys. And it's the wonderful thing about a rural setting is the wildlife until they start eating your plants.
Oh, yeah, it's all good. You know, when you see Bambi in the backyard, and you're like, you go get your spouse, hey, look at this, how cute. it's not always a cute thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I know Denny, our bird man, can appreciate this. I love feeding the birds. I love watching. A couple of my favorites are Blue Jays and Cardinals. And of course, we have a lot of finches that have been coming here and just an entire variety. Mm-hmm. The bad news is I think I have tripled the squirrel population on my street because of the food that we set out.
Oh, yeah.
That's
secondary. That comes next, you know.
Now, here's what bothers me about the squirrels. I don't mind them because I think every once in a while about my old man when he would say things that come back to you. Don't worry about those squirrels, boy. We might have to eat them sometime sooner or later. Okay, Dad. We'll keep them close, too.
that's the clamp it approach, isn't it?
Provide a source of food if need be. But I'll put those ears of corn out there.
Right.
And the squirrels will go right by it and pick the peanut ring that I got from Ed's Feed and Seed.
Uh-huh.
Clean the peanuts and avoid the corn until it's the only thing left.
Well, you know, sometimes you have to, if you're going to feed the birds, you also have to, you know, set up some sort of a feeding station for the squirrel.
Sure.
And, you're talking about the ears of corn. Have you ever seen where you can purchase those bungee cords that go up and down, and you could put an ear of corn on it. Those are fun to watch squirrels on.
Yeah.
The other thing, too, you can buy, it's like a little wheel, and it might hold 4 ears of corn, and you attach it to a tree, and it will spin. And they'll spin along with it.
That just sounds mean.
Well, no, it's kind of fun to watch. You know, the squirrels make way and make do with what's going on with what they're trying to feed with. But you know, and two, this is a little tip, and I'm sure you know a lot of people already know about this. If you have bird feeders like metal poles or what have you, just take a little bit of oil and wipe, you know, along that pole, and they'll slide right down it.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun to watch all the wildlife in the backyard. Coming up in just a few minutes, we've got Doug on the line from Hamilton. He's got a question for you about growing some peas, but we do need to take a break in and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys. We'll be right back. Welcome back in and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys. And Tony, we have Doug on the line from Hamilton. He's got a question for you about growing some peas. Some sweet peas, Doug, or?
Yes, I believe they are.
Okay. What are you trying to
maybe
do?
Maybe they're snap peas.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Me and my dad have never grown them.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad he has a hell of a green thumb.
Mm-hmm.
But this is the first time we've tried them, and they're dying.
Tell me a little bit about when you tried these. Did you start these from seed?
Yes, started them from seed.
Okay.
I've never been able to find a plant.
Right. When did you plant those?
We planted them we planted everything else, you know, late April, early May.
Okay. Yeah, usually, you know, and you still should have been okay. Peas are more suitable just as you planted those. You know, they're more of a cool season crop. You can sometimes start them a little earlier.
Okay.
And usually you plant those early spring, just like you did, or, you know, late summer. Sometimes people will come back and try and get a second crop with them going into the fall months where it gets cool again.
Right.
And so are these in a raised bed? Are they in the ground?
Just in the ground, regular garden, you know, nothing fancy. You know, mm-hmm. Me and my dad are not fancy people. When I say fancy, you know, raised beds and all that. No, ours is just a regular garden. I live on 2.5 acres out in the middle of nowhere.
And what exactly is happening to the plant itself? Is it like collapsing or?
They're collapsing and they're turning yellow.
Interesting. You know, usually what's interesting when you grow peas, too, is that a lot of times they get their nitrogen from the atmosphere. And you don't always have to apply as much nitrogen as necessary.
I don't do nothing. I put a little bit of 12-12 on it, and that's
right,
it.
Right. Yeah, and I can't say exactly what's happening to the peas. You know, I've never grown peas before to even have experienced it to tell you perhaps what's going on. I know as long they don't want to stay wet either, you know, and if you think that area may be, you know, holding a lot of moisture, we've had quite a bit of rain actually this year, but if you've been watering in addition to the rain, the rainfall that we've been getting.
I haven't pulled a garden hose out yet this year.
No, most of us haven't had to either. So, are all the plants doing that? Have you tried to fertilize a little bit with something kind of, organic and gentle, so to speak,
I have, and then my neighbor, he's, you know, I live out in the sticks. So my neighbor, he's a big farmer.
Yeah.
And I've asked him, and he's gave me a little bit of liquid nitrogen.
Yeah.
And we've tried that. And, you know, when I put it in the ground, I just use little, you know, handheld pump sprayer.
Right. Right.
And I stay about 2 or 3 inches off of the row,
mm-hmm.
and I just spray it directly into the ground.
Yeah. You know, the only thing I could suggest that you might do is perhaps take one of the plants into the extension office and see if they can identify anything that, you know, that is obvious, or they can send it off and have it, you know, examined. You know, and I would also encourage you maybe to take a little bit of the soil and make sure there isn't anything soil borne, you know, from a fungal issue that might be affecting the peas. I know that, you know, I have seen them yellow before around the base. And I know that sometimes, you know, I've heard of people even mentioning that they've withered back and died, just as you're saying. So right. I don't know if that could be a type of blight of any sort or not.
What about tomatoes? Why would my tomato plant be dying?
Well, you know, with some of the high humidity and so forth and what we've been experiencing with high temperatures, you know, that affects a lot of our garden plants as well. And,
okay.
You know, like your tomatoes, are you planting those in the same spot year after year?
No, we rotate. Normally, we do our rows east to west.
Mm-hmm.
And then the following year, the next year, we'll go north and south.
Right. So you're...
And when we do that, our tomatoes are either on the south end of the garden or the north end or the east end. It all depends how we plant them.
Right, right. What
now,
exactly...
Last year, we put all our tomato plants on the west end of the garden, and I think we might have got two tomatoes before they all died.
What's exactly happening to the tomato plants? Are you starting to notice any yellowing from the lower leaves up, or
they're turning brown from the top down?
From the top down. You know, I don't know if you might be experiencing any type of an early season blight for any reason, a fusarium wilt. There's a lot of things that can really affect tomato plants, and it's really hard to detect those. And
right.
That's when
I've been doing the old Indian trick of putting eggshells, because I did have a bug there for a little bit.
Yeah. Well, the eggshells are giving you that element of calcium. So.
Right.
Yeah. You know, really the best thing I can suggest that you do is take it into a garden center or nursery, see if they can help you identify some things with both the peas and the tomato plants. Or perhaps, get with your extension office, your local extension office, and see if they can identify any of the issues. Because, you know, tomato plants, you know, they can be afflicted with a lot of different issues. And now we're right at that prime time in the season with, as Ernie, you know, we started out the show talking about last week's weather. I was out of town. But when you have high humidity and you have moisture and that combination, it starts creating some problems, especially with tomato plants, pepper plants, those things come into play. It's all environmental. And, something else that I would encourage you to do or others that have gardens or are experiencing some issues, I always like to mulch with newspapers and apply straw. Because a lot of times when you get those heavy rains, when the rain pelts the soil surface, it gets those... soil-borne spores up and moving, and that's when they start getting on the lower parts of the plants, especially tomato plants. And, you know, having your extension office send it off and they can look at things under a microscope, they can tell you exactly what's happening. And if you're experiencing any of those blight issues and so forth, you can pretty well rest assured that you're going to start having those issues again from this point forth if you're planting in the same spot.
Okay.
There's a lot of things.
You know, because I'm normally, by this time, I'm, like my beans are doing great.
Right, right.
And, by this time, 2 years ago, I already had 60 quarts of tomatoes done.
Yeah, it's all weather related.
So.
Well, Doug, follow up with this and check with the Hamilton County Extension Office. And see what in fact you can find out. Take a little, take a sample of both your, the pea plant and the tomato plant, and then a little bit of soil around where those peas are, and make sure that nothing's soil-borne from that standpoint, or it would be a blight. All right, Doug, thanks for following up with us. Okay, bud.
Yep.
Bye.
749-B105 in and around the house with Tony and Ernie. Before we go into the break, we have Rock on the line for Price Show. He has a quick comment about the peas. Hey, Rock, what do you think?
Well, number one, when we grew peas, they went in with the onions, which was like mid-March.
Okay.
Now, granted, this was New Jersey, but mid-March, a little earlier, the peas went in the ground.
Right, and they like that cooler temperature.
By July, they were done.
Right.
Oh, okay.
They can't handle the heat.
Right. No, they can't handle the heat. They're more of a cool weather performer, and getting them in a little early is best. Ernie, Barb Sondergrath?
I do.
Yeah, I was just at her house a couple weeks ago, and her peas were just coming on perfect, and I pulled a couple off of there and just opened those up, and they were tasty. So, people should be harvesting those right now.
Yeah, they should be about done, ready to be harvested and finished.
Absolutely.
The other thing I was going to comment on is you said something about rural living and animals and whatever.
Uh-huh.
We live in Price Hill, and I was outside looking at our tomato plants, and something has chewed the top off of all our tomato plants. We think it's either a groundhog or possibly a raccoon.
Right.
But in fact, we're going, really? In Price Hill?
Deer. Deer, you know, I don't know if you have a deer issue over there, but
we have woods right next to us that deer could come out of, yes.
Yeah, deer have already topped my tomato plants for me.
Oh, man.
That's what the something just come in and just picked all the tops off, cleaned all the leaves off, and in the cages. I mean, they're nice cleaning them off around the cages and stuff.
I'm a victim as well. I feel violated. exactly that. Just the other day, you know, for the first time, my wife was giving me a hard way about it. She goes, you know the deer are going to get to them. You know the deer are going to get to them. And I talk about deer products. I have them, right there at my fingertips to take off the shelf at work, and I've yet to do it. So I go out one day, and and you know what? I don't think really they eat the leaves that often. They'll bite them off and drop them. So, but they're topping them. It's the deer.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Appreciate the call.
Hey, thanks for the info, too, on the peas. That's a good point. Yeah, it's a little earlier season crop. That's for sure.
Yeah.
Thanks, Rock.
About August is the second crop, I believe.
Yep.
Mid to late August to get them started, and then they go into September and October. Just got to make sure you keep them watered here because we do have a tendency to get dry in September.
That's right.
True.
All right, Rock, have a good weekend. Thanks for the info, bud.
749-B105, in and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys. Need to pause for a moment when we come back.
Well, we're going to head, with whatever's bothering you, give us a yell, but I'm going to hit a little bit on some Nutsedge, too, and some products that you can use to get rid of that, and because the temperatures and the weather we've been having, this stuff loves that kind of weather.
We'll be right back.
Welcome back in and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys, and had a flurry of calls. And if you got something that's bugging you or if you got a question, 749-B105. You can also stay connected to us with our Facebook page. Look us up and like us. We're going to like you right back. But a lot of things might be creeping into your lawn, and we're going to talk a little bit about that. One of Tony's favorites, Nutsedge.
Well, I pretty much have that under control.
Oh, do you?
It has taken me a while
to
do that, but occasionally if I see something, I'm on it right away.
Yeah.
But Nutsedge, too, you know, we were talking a couple of segments ago about crabgrass. You know, I'm seeing a lot of that, and it's you know, it's on the move, and just what you were talking about when we first opened up the show this morning, you know, last week's weather is conducive for this stuff, and it just takes off. You know, high humidity, you know, you get the moisture, those two elements combined, you know, just makes way for crabgrass activity and also Nutsedge.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Nutsedge can really be a problem in the lawn, and it's just not an overnight fix all the time either. You know, it takes a little bit of time. It takes some effort, and you have to be diligent about it. You know, just don't give up and go at it once. And also refrain from pulling, too.
I was just about to say that. I can remember clearly early in our association on In and Around the House, that came up, and you said the first thing to remember is never pull it because it has little seed pods on the bottom of it.
Yeah, you have the little nutlets underground, you know, in that whole root network or structure. And when you spray Nutsedge, you have to keep this in mind. You might come back the following season next year and say, you know, I remember that being in this area, and I sprayed. Why isn't that product that effective? Well, it is effective because it really goes after the parent plant.
Right.
But underground, that network, you know, you have those little nutlets, those little bulblets that they come up usually the following season, if not that season, the current season I'm speaking of.
Mm-hmm.
But that's why it can be a 2-year process, maybe a 3-year process to get rid of some Nutsedge issues. But no worries. There are some products out there that will help you get things under control. And that's what we're trying to do is control it, if not totally eradicate it at all measures. But you know, you can pick up High Yields Nutsedge Killer at your local garden centers and nurseries. And that's in a real little box. And you'll mix it with 1 gallon of water. It comes in a little cellophane packet. Now, when you open up that box and you pull out that cellophane packet, don't tear the cellophane packet because it will dissolve on its own once you drop it into water.
Oh.
So you don't get that on your hands. Don't get it on your fingertips. Don't go rubbing your eyes and all that good stuff.
Don't think you have to help it.
You don't have to help it. You just drop that into a gallon of water. And this product has to be applied with a tank sprayer. So, again, know what it is exactly that's in your tank sprayer and always keep it labeled properly. So what you're going to do is mix one of these Nuts Edge Killer packets. It's a high-yield product. You'll find it at your local garden centers and nurseries. You will mix it exactly with 1 gallon. But most importantly, and what makes this product most effective, is that you use a spreader sticker. When we talk about a spreader sticker, it's a product that serves as a surfactant. You know, it helps what it is that we're spraying adhere to it a lot better.
Mm-hmm.
And the better that product adheres to the blade or whatever it is that we're spraying, the more effective that product's going to be. And what makes Nuts Edge tough to eradicate sometimes is that blade in itself is waxy. And when you spray it without using a surfactant, guess what? It just repels off. It kind of giggles and laughs at you while it's looking up at you holding that tank sprayer. And it's not as effective. So a lot of times when you're not as effective killing Nuts Edge, that could be the very reason why, is because you're not using a surfactant or a spreader sticker. And a lot of times people will say, hey, I'll use dishwashing detergent. That's fine and dandy. I would probably suggest that you maybe use a little bit of Dawn. And keep this in mind. Mix the Nuts Edge Killer with the water first and stir it up thoroughly. And then ever so slightly take a teaspoon of the dishwashing detergent and drop it in there and agitate it lightly. Don't put it all into the tank sprayer at one time and gun it with a water faucet
right,
or your hose, because it's going to foam up like a rabid dog. It's going to get all over the place. So that's the approach you want to take. Now, there are some other products out there, too, that you can find on the garden center shelves. Another product that will work for, you know, the Nuts Edge issue is anything that contains soft French Ozone.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you can use that as well. So any one of those two types of products will work effectively in helping you control and get your Nuts Edge problem under siege, so to speak. So, it's just this weather, all these things are going to start really just taking off. Nuts Edge and crabgrass. So don't allow that to happen. Be on top of it. And the reason why we're talking about it this morning is because, unlike last week, we have some nice days here ahead of us, which makes it conducive for spraying these, you know, the grasses or anything that's broadleaf weed that's in the lawn, and it's more effective.
749-B105 and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys. Tony, we have Dwight on the line from Hebron, who's got a question. He's got some patchy grass issues. Hi, Dwight. Thanks for the call. What's going on?
Oh, well, I appreciate you taking my call and getting to talk to you.
Sure.
I've got my yard. Last year, I took you guys' advice, and I overseeded and aerated and overseeded my lawn. And then this year, my grass came back pretty nice. I have one of the main companies come out and, you know, do the spraying on my yard and all, but there's areas of my grass, like I can see the green grass on top, but then down under it, it looks like dead grass just laying there under it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to figure out what that might be and how I can remove it without without doing any harm to what I've got established from, you know, last season.
Gotcha.
You know, did you sow the grass seed, or did a lawn company do that for you?
I sowed it with a hand spreader.
Okay. And this is another element that comes into play, and this is really interesting to say the least. Now, the seed that you used, was it a blend by chance?
Yes, it was a blend. I forget now. I thought I had the bag out here in the garage, but I apparently have thrown it away. It was kind of like a mixture. It was a small blend, but it was what several people had recommended for this area. Even the company that sprays the yard said what they recommended.
Well, a lot of times in the blends, and I'm not going to say that your blend actually had this in it or not, there are occasions where you're going to find a type of bluegrass in there, perhaps.
Okay.
And when we get really hot and you have a lack of moisture, bluegrass is one of those types of turfs that will go dormant earlier than other turfs when there's a lack of moisture. Now, we've not really had that much lack of moisture this year. It seems like we've had some timely rains, which is has been a huge benefit, and a lot of the lawns are still looking pretty good. You know, a lot of times, you know, when you were just explained to me that you had some green in there, but you also had some brown. So yeah, that could be part of what's coming into play here, and it may not be, okay?
Okay.
But what I would do is just gently rake that out. Don't tear into it hard because you don't want to remove what's there that's looking good. And I want you to be ready to turn the corner here as we get towards the tail end of next month, the month of August, mm-hmm. and be ready to sow seed in the fall again.
Okay.
So what we're going to do, we're going to go after some of these areas that didn't quite fill in to your satisfaction. And what else you need to do is make sure that there isn't any type of a pre-emergent product that's been applied to your lawn when you do this.
Okay.
So I would go back at it. I would use a tall fescue, and one that we've been talking about here a lot this past spring is Fine Lawn H2O.
Okay.
It has water certification, and it's an improved Fine Lawn Elite, and it's supposed to use a lot less water, which is what we're trying to look for as we progress and go into the future, because a lot of times, you know, when there's a lack of moisture, we go through drought periods. Some areas, especially like out in California and other different places, there's water restrictions. So we're starting to look at the water conservation element about what we're doing with seed. But I want you to use Fine Lawn H2O.
Okay.
Fill in some of those bare spots at the beginning of September, and you see things coming really well for you. And at the same time, I would either use a seed starter fertilizer, or if your lawn's still thick enough, you can use the orange bag, the Lawn Food Plus Iron from Fertilume, and that will work just as well.
Okay. All right, sounds good. That's what I'll definitely do. I know my yard's got a lot of clay, you know, mixed in with the dirt. And when I try to water my lawn, instead of it, like, absorbing, like, quickly into the lawn,
uh-huh.
I noticed I've got, like, patches where, like, water will stand, and it takes a little longer to get into the dirt.
Okay.
So is that okay, like, when I'm watering, that if I have water in there and standing, or should I cut back on my water and not have it stand?
You should do one or two things, and maybe both. I would cut back a little bit on the watering.
Okay.
And I would also maybe raise those areas where they're level. So,
okay.
You know what? Hang in there for a second. We're going to take a quick break because I still have a couple of things I want to add to what you're doing. And I think it would be of some benefit for you. So hang in there with us. And give us a call here, 749-B105. I'm Tony with Ernie, your local home and gardening guys. And we'll be right back.
Welcome back in and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys. We still have Dwight on the line who's we're trying to help out with some patchy grass issues. Thanks for hanging on, Dwight.
Yeah, no problem.
Yeah, where are you calling from? I'm sorry.
Over in Hebron, Kentucky.
Okay, that's what I thought you said. First and foremost, what I would do, I just want to add a couple of things here before we conclude. I would take a soil sample of your lawn.
Okay.
And you're right there by the Boone County Extension Office. Great people out there. And see Joe Smith.
Okay.
And take that soil sample to Joe, because now we're way ahead of the game here as we start to go into, you know, we're in summer, but we're fast approaching. Believe me, fall will be here before you know it when it's time to sow seed again. But see Joe, taking a soil sample out there. What I want you to do is just randomly, you know, go down a couple of inches in the soil surface throughout the yard. Don't just do one area, just throughout. Take that soil sample and put it in one bucket. And mix it all up together, okay? And then take that out there, put it in a paper bag, do it early in the week so they can send it off to the University of Kentucky, and let's just see if we need to do anything additional to the soil before we, you know, before we proceed on and, you know, sow seed and so forth in the fall.
Okay.
Now, real quick, when it comes to watering, you know, you had mentioned that some of the areas were pooling. That's not really good. You know, you might want to consider adding some topsoil to those spots, or even better, what I've done, if it's small enough, I've kind of taken my spade and have gone into the areas that were low-lying, if they're small, and made like a cross, and then I would peel back the grass and add some soil underneath, and you know, almost like you're taking sod.
Okay.
And peeled it back, added some soil underneath, and rolled everything back out, or just add some topsoil. You don't want any pooling. That's not good.
Okay.
And other than that, you know, as we get into, you know, the hot part of the summer and we don't get any precipitation, make sure, this is so important, that you at least get 1 inch of water on your lawn a week if we don't get any rainfall.
Okay.
And water longer and less often. So what I don't want people doing is watering all the time every couple of days and just getting enough in there for the top part of the soil, because what we're not encouraging our lawn to do is root deeper when we do that. We want those roots deeper. That's why we want a longer watering period, less often.
Okay.
All right.
I've got it all wrote down, and I'll get with you guys sometime next year and let you know how it's going after I get all this done.
All right, Dwight. Sounds good.
We want to follow along and check your progress.
All right. Appreciate y'all's show. Thanks.
Thanks for listening. Oh. Tony, on our Facebook page, I hope I'm saying this correctly, Dorlisa Lewis heard us talking about nut sedge this morning and wanted us to remind her what the treatment was called, you know, one that dissolves in the gallon of water, and how much Dawn detergent does she need to add. So she's looking for some more information.
You want to look for the high-yield nut sedge control, and you can only find that at your local garden centers and nurseries. And it's very effective. You got to stay with it, but you're going to mix one packet that's in that box to a gallon of water exactly. Mix that solution, that combination up thoroughly, and then add a teaspoon of dishwashing detergent, preferably Dawn. I think Dawn still has a fair amount of a surfactant built into it.
Mm-hmm.
And if not, then you can buy a spreader sticker. High Yield also makes that. And that's worth having on the shelf. It doesn't go bad. And that just makes things easier all the time, and it's applied the same way.
749 B105 in and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys. Need to pause for a moment when we come back.
Let's talk about the plant of the week.
Plant of the week.
Yes.
When we return, we'll be right back. Welcome back in and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys. A couple of ways to stay connected with us. You can email us in and around the house at b105.com. Jump onto our Facebook, In and Around the House, and drop us a message, and we'll be happy to stay connected with you as well. Going to be a beautiful weekend, a little bit less humidity, temperatures up in the mid-80s, lots of sunshine. Great time to get out to your locally owned, independently operated garden center and then out into your yard to get some things done and your landscaping, and we have the plant of the week for you.
How about that? Listen to this.
Okay.
This is one flamboyant perennial. It is. And this particular plant, this particular perennial, it's shrub form.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's herbaceous. It dies back to the ground every year. And their flowers can be close to the size of a dinner plate. No kidding.
Wow.
Almost, you know, at least, you know, close to 10 inches across.
Uh-huh.
And right now, they are in their heyday.
And what
they're
is it?
Blooming. It's the hardy hibiscus. What do you think about that?
We had a hibiscus question earlier.
Yeah, but that was the tropical version.
Okay.
But their gigantic flowers are exotic, charismatic to some, and others, they just think, oh, it's just so-so, but I think they rock. And you're going to like some of the names. I'm going to talk about a couple that I like in particular.
Okay.
But today's perennial hibiscus are totally different than what they used to be. A lot of us are familiar with some of the older varieties, Lord Baltimore, Copper King. However, with hybridization and all that good stuff, we've come up with some different varieties today that we didn't have back then. So these aren't the hardy hibiscus that your grandma used to have. So these are well worth looking for your local garden centers and nurseries. And right now, they're in bloom. My neighbor has a beautiful, and I know it's Midnight Marvel, and we'll talk about that in a moment. When I was going down to the mailbox yesterday, I was admiring my neighbor's Midnight Marvel hardy hibiscus. Beautiful dark foliage, big red, robust, I mean, just deep red, mm-hmm. robust-looking blooms. Awesome.
That's the plant of the week.
And you can find these, you know, like I said, at your local garden centers and nurseries. They're available in a variety of colors, sizes. The foliage is different on some, different hues and colors to the foliage and so forth, along with the blooms. They're beautiful. And there are even a couple of smaller varieties that aren't as tall as what you typically see with a hardy hibiscus, because they average, you know, you can typically find them around 4 to 5 feet. That's what they'll grow to. And there are some, you know, that stay around a 3 foot range. But nonetheless, they are in their heyday right now. They are in their glory. They are blooming. They are putting on a show like no other. And if you're seeing these around the neighborhood as you're driving or wherever, and you want one, stop by your local garden center or nursery and see what's in stock, because right now is where they're at their best. So, you know, bloom time, typically it's mid to late summer through early to mid fall. So you get a fair amount of bloom time with the hardy hibiscus. Mm-hmm. Have you seen what I'm talking about? Or have you ever noticed?
Mm-hmm.
And there's some people who are like, hey, can I propagate that? You can. It's easily done by just taking some cuttings. And if you're using cuttings, always look for a rooting powder when you take cuttings. But you can propagate that way. I'm not sure some of the newer varieties, if the seeds are viable or not. I know some of the others, they are. They can vary. But also division in early spring is another way that you can propagate the hardy hibiscus. And maintenance. You know, what do we think when it comes to maintenance? And it's really simple with a hardy hibiscus. I mean, they love the sun, and most importantly, they need moist, well-drained soil. That's of the essence, mm-hmm. because keeping hibiscus looking well throughout the season, you know, they got to be watered well enough to give you that resulting large flower blooms and lush foliage. So keep that in mind. They like well-drained soil. That's so important. They don't want to sit in an area, almost like the echinaceas when we were talking about those last week. They do not want to sit in an area that stays wet all winter, so keep that in mind. And also, as we progress through the summer months, if you have a hardy hibiscus, deadheading, you know, when we talk about deadheading, that means just removing the spent blooms keeps them looking better from an appearance standpoint.
Gotcha.
Okay, so that's really important as well. It's best, too, I always say this when people are looking for hardy hibiscus, it's always best to plant those early as possible. When they're readily available, get them in the ground so they can get rooted in. That's what's important here, because they should be mulched in heavily their first winter. Right. So you want them to get rooted in. So don't try and plant one late in the year. You might get away with it and you might not, but we need them to get rooted in, and we need to mulch them heavily their first season so they make that winter. And in the spring, you cut back any of the remaining stems. I like to cut them back to about 4 inches to 6 inches before the new growth appears. So that's when you want to prune those in the spring, late winter, early spring. And I would also encourage you, when you prune those back, to have a strong pair of loppers or a small hand pruning saw to make the necessary cuts when you prune those back. Here's a little note. This is a big note. Hibiscus, they are always one of the last perennials to emerge in the spring. So don't think they're gone.
Yeah.
So don't write them off. Don't lift up that plant and discard it and throw it away and go back to your nursery or garden center early the next spring and say, hey, this plant's dead. That's not at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they are one of the last to emerge, and that's why you want to prune them back before they start fleshing out with new growth. And this is what's great about this particular plant. Although it's one of the last to flesh out or emerge in the spring, because of its vigorous growth rate, it makes up for its late appearance in the spring. So don't worry about it.
Okay.
Other than that, they're beautiful to have in the landscape. There's a number of different things that you can use them for. You know, when it comes to what kind of usage would a hardy hibiscus, how would it come into play in the landscape? You can plant them in a grouping. They'll be very attractive from that standpoint. You can also plant them out in the landscape as a standalone kind of specimen. They're very attractive from that standpoint as well. But only one little drawback sometimes with a hardy hibiscus. Other than that, you're golden. And that is, Japanese beetles love them.
Uh-oh.
So a couple things that you can do. We were talking about Japanese beetles last week, if you remember that, Ernie.
I do.
You know, you can, you know, always put some products on her to keep that activity down. But always keep in mind, too, because it's a large blooming flower that attracts pollinators and hummingbirds, to say the least. You know, that you'll get a lot of hummingbird activity around these. Be careful with what you're using. So you might just put up with some of the Japanese beetle activity.
749 B105 in and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys. Here you have the plant of the week. And when we come back,
I'm going to talk about a couple of my favorites when it comes to the hardy hibiscus and put some emphasis here. If you want to check out one of my favorites, and I love cheesecake, it's on our Facebook page.
We have cheesecake on the Facebook page?
You might.
Well, we'll be right back. Welcome back in and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys. And we've been talking a little bit about the plant of the week. Hibiscus.
And I just want to touch base, sum it up with some of my favorites, just a couple. One in particular, you know, as mentioned before we went into the break, cheesecake. There's one called cherry cheesecake. And I love cheesecake. But this particular hibiscus is stunning, to say the least. And, I mean, its blooms, too, are quite large, you know, 8 to 10 inches across, with white flowers that are tipped with the, like this magenta color. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you can see it on our Facebook page or not.
Looking at it now.
And also the flower petals of this particular hardy hibiscus are unique in a way that they're kind of ruffled, which I like that texture. So I think all those things coming together into play, so to speak, with this, that, and if you look at the veining, you see that magenta color? Now, you know, I shouldn't be asking you this. I know that you're colorblind. Can you see what I'm trying to point out to you?
It might not be what you see, but I do see some differences in those.
Okay,
colors.
I just, you know, as I was getting into the color variations here of the flower petal, I'm thinking, you know, Ernie's colorblind. Yeah. I'm pointing this out to you.
Well, that's all right. But man, those are gigantic blooms.
They are. You can see the one photograph in relation to the hand, mm-hmm. how big they are.
Right.
And cherry cheesecake, you know, I just, that veining color, how it radiates out to the outer edge where it's got those magenta tips,
uh-huh.
and that cherry red center, it's stunning. And with that, like that white creamy stamen right there, I mean, you can't ask for a better looking flower petal. It's beautiful. It really is. It's stunning.
It really is.
And, you know, you can check these out on our Facebook page. Another one that I posted on there that I like a lot, too, is because I'm really into foliage, you know. For me, it's not always the bloom, but the blooms are very, very important.
Right.
But it's Midnight Marvel. You know, I like that red foliage that it possesses, or it's like a dark burgundy-colored foliage. However you see it or want to define it as being, it's still attractive. Mm-hmm. So those are just two that I like a lot. And the cherry cheesecake, you know, everyone, you know, a lot of times people ask me, how do they come up with these names?
Right.
Well, I don't know. I don't know if there's a group of people sit down at a table and say, hey, this is what it is or what it may look like. I don't know.
Someone had a craving when they saw the plant, went, you know what would be really good right now is some cherry cheesecake.
Right. That's
beautiful plant.
It is. It's gorgeous.
Yeah.
And cherry cheesecake is part of a series. You know, a lot of times you'll find various plant species in a series. And this particular series that I want to point out to you is called the Summerific Series Collection. And they are proven winners, and a lot of people like the proven winner brand.
Mm-hmm.
But they are in the Summerific series, and cherry cheesecake is one of my favorites. There's also Cranberry Crush. There's Summer Storm. There's Berrylicious. So all these are food-related items that I think that you can relate to, Ernie.
Yeah, it's funny you say that because we're right across the street from the Graders here on Reading Road, and I was just thinking, I'm going to have to go over there and get a cheese crown just to celebrate.
You know, I'm not into things that are sweet, but those cheese crowns, they're dangerous.
Oh, my God.
And, you know, it's like I'll eat too many of those before my brain signals to, you know, gives me the signal that you're full. It's like, how many have you had already? Three?
You eat what?
Those cheese crowns.
Too many of them?
Oh.
I didn't know there was a too many.
Well, you're right. Until you feel bad, you know? It's until you feel bad.
749-B105, in and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys. We need to pause for a moment. When we come back,
Let's touch base on some of our annuals that we have. What do we need to do to keep those looking good?
We'll be right back. Welcome back in and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys. And, boy, we've had a lot going on. Matter of fact, I just looked out the window, and our friend from Arling House has arrived. Ryan is going to be in at 8 o'clock to talk with us. And we'll share a couple of things with him coming up. But we've talked about hibiscus. We've talked about grass issues. We've been covering a lot of ground.
A little bit. And, you know, I was just admiring something yesterday when Tina and I got back from Atlanta. And we were like, I wonder how our plants are doing, because we didn't really call on anyone to water for us.
Yeah.
And we've been using plants that don't require as much water. And one of those, you know, is the lantana. And we have this pot on the deck. We have, it's a lantana, or I'll say that. Lantana is
Wembley.
It's a lantana in a tree form.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. And it's a kind of a deep orange, reddish color, and it's in full bloom, and the hummingbirds love it. And these plants, lantana, they just rock and roll. We were talking a little bit about those last week, and they just love the heat. You can't throw enough heat at them. But anyway, having said that, these are some things that you need to do to keep your annuals looking at their best as we progress throughout the summer months. And we'll talk about this, you know, at various points throughout you know, the rest of July and August, because I consider July and August maintenance months. These are the months that, you know, we just need to maintain what we've done in the spring to keep it looking good until we change things out in the fall, which is not too far away, by the way.
Right.
But fertilization, you know, our plants, they like to be fed, kind of like you, Ernie. We all like
we
to
all
eat,
like
you know?
To be fed.
We all like to be fed. And these are just a couple of fertilizers that I would recommend that you use, any one of these particular three I think highly enough of, that I know that I can expect some great results from these fertilizers. One is Fertilum's Blooming and Rooting, and this particular fertilizer, it has a high middle number, phosphorus, which gives us bloom production. So the analysis on the Blooming and Rooting from Fertilum is a 9 in nitrogen, 58 in phosphorus, 8 in potash. So this is a good fertilizer to use for your blooming plants. And it's real simple. You know, the mixture ratio for the blooming and rooting, 1 teaspoon per gallon of water for a containerized plant. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And now this is interesting too. You know, it's not always that we water in our plants with fertilizers. You can also fertilize our plants by just getting these products on the foliage. So we call that foliar feeding, foliar fertilizing. So if you want to use this from a foliar standpoint, Fertilum's Blooming and Rooting, you're just going to mix up a quarter of a teaspoon to a quart of water and spritz it, put it in a spray bottle and spritz it on the foliage. A lot of times you can get really good performance and results by, you know, just a real light foliar feeding on your plants.
Right.
Another one, too, if you don't have the time to mix anything up, those water-soluble types of products, then, you know, I love Osmocote. That's the granular, slow-release fertilizer that we talk about often that you can put into the containers, your window boxes, and so forth after you plant. You do that usually in the spring and just scratch it into the soil surface. And every time you water, or every time it rains, it's a slow release fertilizer. It breaks down and it's making everybody in those containers happy and they're well fed. So that's another good fertilizer to use. And also, last but not least, this particular fertilizer I like a lot. And it's been designed for plants that do not take up, you know, iron efficiently. And I'm talking about Jack's Classic for petunias. That analysis is a little different than what I just mentioned a second ago from Fertilum's Blooming and Rooting, which Fertilum's Blooming and Rooting, listen to this analysis, is a 958.8. Jack's Classic is a 2622. So that middle number in these two is on opposite ends of the spectrum when it comes to phosphorus. But the Jack's Classic is geared towards our Calibrachoas, which are also called or known as Million Bells and Petunias. They love iron, and they need it, and that's what makes them look their best. If they're getting a little ratty, get a pair of scissors, just go out there and give them a little bit of a haircut, fertilize, and wait it out for a couple of weeks, and your plants are going to respond favorably. So just a little maintenance tip there for keeping our annuals looking nice. In addition to watering correctly, trying your best when you water to water underneath the foliage. Don't get your plants wet, especially at night when it's, you know, warm and there's a lot of humidity. We start setting ourselves up for diseases. So that's not a good situation to put yourself in, watering that way. Also, I see this all the time. I know some people will disagree with me about this type of watering approach. I do not like to water at 2 in the afternoon when the sun is beaming down on my annuals and I'm going at it with a hose and I'm getting the blooms wet. You know, when the, I think when the sun evaporates the moisture off of those bloom petals, we lose the longevity element of that bloom period. So, and there's probably people that are going to argue that with me tooth and nail. That's my opinion. That's what I've experienced. So don't get those blooms wet.
Right.
Water underneath.
You called it overhead watering or something.
Overhead watering, overhead irrigation. Right. I, you know, it's not a good watering practice or a good habit to get into, you know, especially at night too. You know, when we're watering with overhead irrigation at night, we really set ourselves up for some disease issues. When you go through the overnight hours, this is really what's taking place. A lot of times, not as much air movement.
Right.
Okay, we don't have any light or sun that helps evaporate some of the moisture off from the foliage. So the moisture hangs out. It resides on the foliage for a longer period of time. And because of that, you know, that's what brings about disease issues. And it's and then all of a sudden you're experiencing some powdery mildew problems, maybe some cercospora or leaf spot, you name it. It's just not a good position to put yourself in. And that also applies for tomato plants. You know, we talk about diseases with tomato plants. You know, that's a sure way to get it. You know, just overhead irrigate at night, and you're more than likely going to end up with some issues.
749-B105 in and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys. Coming up at the top of the hour, we're going to have our friend Ryan from Arling House Heating and Air join us. And we need to pause for a moment when we come back.
You know, before our friends from Arling House join us, let's try and sneak in there a couple little tips that we can take and apply around the house. If you're starting to see a little bit of insect activity, a couple big ants hanging out at my house, and I'm thinking, might be time for me to do a little, take a little action.
We'll be right back. Welcome back. In and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys. Tony, we got Ruth on the line from Indiana, who has some burying trees, I guess, and birds are, what's going on? What's going on? You got some birds eating your berries?
Good morning. How are you?
Wonderful. Well, thanks for the call.
I'm a container gardener. Okay.
Yeah.
And I was wanting to know if there's some dwarf berry trees or seed trees that I can plant in the container that would winter for the birds.
You know, you have a couple of options, but what really comes into play and what I have to ask you first is, you know, what size container? You really need something of substance size-wise.
Mine are 4 inches, 4 foot deep and 3 foot deep.
Okay.
And then I have them, 18 to 36 inches wide.
Yeah, well, you need to be pretty sizable from a you know, width standpoint.
Okay, how much more sizable do I
need
than what I've already told you?
Well, here's what's going to come into play. And then we're going to come back to sizing and so forth. But anytime you plant a tree species that is commonly planted in the ground and they can easily winter over, when you plant anything of the sort above ground in a container, it's Russian roulette. I mean, anything's likely to happen. You know, once we're above ground and we're exposed to the winter winds and all that other good stuff, we start, you know, it gets a little dicey. So you may, Ruth, get a year out of a tree like that, 2 years or 3 years. Maybe that fifth year it doesn't make it. But what you can do is keep them up close to the house where they're protected somewhere or out near a shed, things of that nature. But, you know, the depth is good with what you were describing, But anything that's 18 inches, that's not enough.
Okay.
You would need something, you know, that's at least 2 to 3 feet across.
Okay.
And what would I do or what would I consider to plant? You know, and again, this all comes into play with how the weather is and how you can protect it. Obviously, dogwoods, you know, when they fruit, the birds love dogwoods.
Mm-hmm. How about viburnum?
Oh,
I never say that right. I'm sorry.
No, viburnums, yeah. Yes. You could probably pull that off as well.
Okay.
You know, they love the fruit on the viburnums. There's nothing mm-hmm. wrong with that. Maybe Sargentii crabapple, which is a low-growing type of crabapple, gets about 5 to 6 foot, and it gets a nice, it grows more horizontally than it does vertically. Quite attractive. That berries up as well. Maybe, you know, and over time, I want you to keep in mind this next tree that I'm going to tell you about. At some point in time, if you get a couple of seasons out of it in a container, you may want to have somebody help you plant it out in a yard somewhere. But this can get a little taller. A hawthorn, the winter king, love that tree.
Okay.
It, too, gives you the berries. We have one at the garden center at one of the houses next to our place. And usually the cedar waxwings are hanging out on it.
Oh, cool.
Later in the year, so as they migrate through.
Okay.
A service berry would be something I would seriously consider, which is probably where I would go first, is with a service berry. But a service berry, they may strip the berries off of that before we get into the winter months, more than likely.
Okay.
Choke berries, any of the aronias, choke berry, one in particular I like a lot, it's called Viking. Those may be suitable.
Okay.
So any of those I would start with first.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure there's some other things that I'm leaving off the table, but those are what come to mind first.
Okay, I'll try some of them then. Thank you so much for your help.
You're welcome, Ruth. Have a good weekend.
Have a great day.
Bye.
749-B105 in and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys. And, Tony, I wanted to ask you, as I was mentioning about driving around, trying to find the alternative route, I saw a plant, and I can't read it. I think I want to say it's the lower part of Hyde Park area where it meets their Columbia Parkway.
Oh, yeah.
Off to the left-hand side.
There's a couple of various, was it Torrance? There's a couple of various. Hill.
Yeah, they cut up
the hill to, is it Madison Avenue they go to? I'm not really sure.
The Torrance Hill is the name of the place. And just at the bottom of that, if you look to the left when you're coming down Torrance, there's a little area that they have planted a bunch of beautiful plants, and there was one that was just gorgeous. It caught my eye. And you mentioned that I'm colorblind, so forgive me if I'm wrong, but it looked orange to me.
Hey, was that the one you're talking about that was various colors and various, like orange and yellow in it, and maybe a little red, green?
I didn't see all that, but the orange.
Only if you're eating the magic mushrooms might you see that color wheel. That's a good color wheel right there.
And so I snapped a photo and I showed it to you, and you were telling me it is a plant called Cronus?
Croton.
Croton.
Yes. Those are awesome. They are tropical, by the way, but I'm glad you brought that up because do not be afraid to mix tropicals or perennials with other plantings in beds.
Mm-hmm.
And the croton, for one, it's very, very vibrant. And most of the, you know, all the colors primarily coming from the foliage itself. That, you know, and that's one of those plants, you know, I talk about, I like foliage. And this is one of those plants that comes into play big time, mm-hmm. is the croton. You don't want to overwater those. You know, they like a little bit on a dry side. And they will take into the fall season with that fall look as well. But they will not winter over outside. And what Ernie's talking about is it's a tropical plant. A lot of those come up from out of the south, the Florida area, and so forth. And they are called crotons. And you can get various types. I don't know all the names to the crotons.
Mm-hmm.
But nonetheless, they're beautiful in containers. They're beautiful in a mass planting, just as you stated.
Yep, and I was confused. I thought it was a big bloom, and you said that's a part of the foliage, so you get an extra level of texture in your landscape bed if you add those.
Oh, big time. Beautiful. You know, and they create a lot of pizzazz, a lot of interest. And when you when you couple those with like some dark colored grasses like Vertigo, which is a Pennisetum, and it's an annual, unfortunately, but a beautiful grass nonetheless. When you couple the Croton with grasses like Vertigo or Pennisetum rubrum, those reds in those grasses really make those pop. Also, the Crotons go well with, like, we were talking about the Calibrachoas, the Million Bells. Crotons will go well with various colors of that plant family, you know, like the reds, the red Million Bells, or the orange, or the yellows.
Right.
So there's a lot of color combination that comes into play. And when we talk about containers, we talk about thrillers, fillers, and spillers. The Croton can be a thriller, depending upon the size of the container, what you have it paired up with. It could also be a filler. And also those spillers that I was just mentioning with the Million Bells and so forth, they play off of that color of the Croton so well. Check it out. It's well, you noticed it. That's all I can say. Right. If you noticed it, I know other people as well.
Sure. 749-B105 in and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys. We need to get Ryan in the studio and get him settled. And when we come back, we're going to have our friend Ryan from Arlinghouse Heating and Air joining us. We'll be right back. Welcome back in and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys. And our friend Ryan from Arlinghouse Heating and Air has joined us again today. And he brought another guest in with us, Brian. And I have to tell you that it's just pretty funny because Tony introduced himself and he said, "I'm Brian." And Tony said, "Yeah, another Brian." And Ryan said, "Yeah, we keep them well stocked over there at Arlinghouse." So welcome to the show, Brian.
Thanks for having us.
And thanks for coming by. Boy, what a roller coaster ride of temperatures already this year.
Yeah, I got to tell you, the heat kind of comes and goes, and, and then, you know, we're getting ready to hit some more 90s next week. We've gotten a few weeks a taste of it here and there, but nothing that's really stuck around with us.
Right. So this is almost as painful, I guess, are stressful on an air conditioning unit, as you could imagine. It comes on, it has to work really hard, then it gets and sits dormant for a while, creating some problems.
You know, it can. I think one of the biggest things right now that we're seeing out there is the lack of maintenance is really starting to catch up with some homeowners. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're still out there doing preventative maintenance for our customers, our Arlinghouse customers that are doing it year in and year out on our maintenance plan. And then, you know, we're getting the new customers or customers that we haven't seen maybe in a few years that are coming back around and, you know, the dirty air filters or the dirty blower wheel, the outside unit that hasn't been pulled apart and cleaned. It's really, really stressful on that outdoor unit.
Sure. Brian, what are you? What's your expertise there at Arlinghouse?
Just general service and also comfort consulting. You know, making sure that our systems that we have in your home, whether it's ours or whether it's an older system that you have,
right,
make sure that it's perfectly clean and operating safely. If your system is inoperable, I'll come out and take a look at it, get it repaired for you, or find an option to, you know, replace it with.
What did you say? Comfort counseling?
Comfort consulting.
We like counseling better.
There's a lot to it.
Yes. It's a little intervention from the air conditioning world. Nothing wrong with that, Ernie. You know what I'm saying?
I do.
Come out a little comforting counseling.
There's a lot to indoor air quality and things that we see on a daily basis with dirty filtration. That's extremely important. We want to make sure that we set a standard for filtration in your home. If you have a fiberglass filter, notice that it's not keeping up, not reducing dust in the house or allergens, you want to look at a pleated media.
Okay. So explain a little bit more about the differences in the filtering systems, because I know some people will, you know, I'm not sure what I have.
Yeah. So there's a couple different types of air filters that are out there. The most common one that we see is just the 1-inch media air filter. So everybody's got that standard 1-inch filter in the home, and then there's a couple of upgraded options that are out there.
Mm-hmm.
The wider pleated filters, the box filters, those can go a lot longer in air filtration. So, and the reason with that is because it creates more surface space on the filter. So there are some media pleated filters that are 4 to 5 inches wide. And then on top of that, there's electronic air cleaners. Some people have to pull apart the electronic air cleaner, and there may be a pre-filter in there that needs to be cleaned every 30 days. So the biggest thing on the air filter is if you're dealing with a 1-inch filter, I don't care what it says on the package, you know, every home should be checked and replaced every 30 to 60 days. If you've got a wider filter, 4-5-inch filter, that's something that can go maybe 6 to 12 months.
Okay. Yeah, the old furnace and filtering system we had at a house was the electronic one. You used to say there were two pieces that we used to have to take out. One was real thin,
yeah,
like a wire mesh, and then the other was pleated, like you said. And I used to have to take them out and hose them off in the sink, and I was shocked how much, I don't want to say dirt, but I guess that's what it is allergens and dust and everything was collected. And if you didn't do that, it wears on the system.
Yeah, you had the old snap, crackle, pop.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's exactly right.
What? Now, what's this? A snap, crackle, pop. Is that like Rice Krispies? I don't get this.
It literally snaps and crackles as air and dust is basically zapped inside this air cooler.
See, I grew up poor, and unlike you, you were rich. We had that old gravity-fed furnace, you know. It just had about 80 arms to it.
Yeah.
That
was the house I grew up in, but the house I live in now, I have one of those. And
snap, crackle, pop. Yeah.
He's right. You would hear that thinking like you were sitting next to a bug zapper once in a while, and I was always shocked. So are most houses with the 1-inch filter, the fiber filter?
That's pretty standard.
Yeah.
Yeah. Most builders are putting that in. You know, we try and do our due diligence with indoor air quality and provide homeowners that, you know, every situation's different. Everybody's setup is a little bit different. If we're able to offer, you know, one of the media air cabinets, which is the 4 or 5 inch wide filter, then, you know, we're going to offer that because it is something that's better for the system. It's better for the air that we're breathing. So,
and it's important to always read the label and to know which direction the airflow goes.
Yeah. There's an arrow on that box on that 4-inch filter.
And do yourself a favor, and I'm speaking from experience, take a magic marker or a Sharpie and mark that on the top of where you do that. You were going to say something, Brian?
Absolutely. Yeah. We'll put the date on the filter that you change.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a great
one. I never thought about that.
Yeah, I always put the date on mine. I'll put it on a little sticker. I got a little sticker on the outside. I'll put the date. I'm fancy now, Ernie, because Arlinghouse, the little red light comes on my thermostat when it needs changed.
And then reminders.
It's got a little reminder. So when I see that little red light at the bottom, I know that,
your thermostat to change your air filter?
You're Skippy. You daggone Skippy.
Yeah.
Modern technology. How you like that?
That's a nice touch there.
Tip on the arrow, no matter where your air filter is, the arrow always points towards the furnace. Every single time. You can't go wrong.
So it's not magnetic north for you.
Right.
Okay, Ernie, that's not always pointing north.
or left or right. You know? Because and I'm telling on myself here, but this should surprise no one that knows me. When it said, you know, airflow out, that confused me. Meaning, is it going out of the house, or is it going out of the machine, or is it coming from the house into or out of the house into the machine? I stood there for 15 minutes trying to figure that out one day.
You know, Ryan, I have to ask you this question. If you're at one of the, at a store that you see that has like 30 filters to choose from.
Oh, yeah.
How in the world do you know what's best suitable for you? Because I've even heard of people who buy those filters. They're like, you know, there's like 30,000 pleats in it. It's real stiff. It's real strong. And they'll tell me, yeah, that thing was whistling Dixie. You know, is that good or is that bad? Or what do you tell a homeowner when you see all these filter choices? What do you really need to hone in on?
Right. So, you know, the first thing I think that a homeowner should understand is that the blower inside the furnace is an air pump, okay? It doesn't generate the air. It just moves the air from the return into the supply. So when we've got something in between that the air pump is, you know, pulling from, you know, we want to use something that's kind of like Goldilocks and the Three Bears here. All right. We don't want something too hot. We don't want it too cold. We want something that's just right. So when you're in that aisle and it can be extremely overwhelming, you know, you want to make sure that first and foremost, you're getting a pleated filter. 100% of the time, a pleated filter. But you don't want to spend $20 a filter on it. Right. You want to find something that's reasonably priced. And, you know, the simplest way that I always tell homeowners is just find the cheapest pleated filter you can find. If you're paying about $2 or $3 a filter, that's perfect. Now, we're just talking about the one-inch filter aisle here. Mm-hmm. So it's just for these one-inch filter customers. That's the best option if they want more air filtration than they need to get an air filtration system. And at that point, we can come in, we can assess the situation, and we can make a recommendation on how we can get that.
749-D105, in and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys. We have Brian and Ryan from Arlinghouse Heating and Air in with us, and we're going to pause for a moment. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about your thermostat. Tony's got the fancy schmancy one. We'll tell you, talk a little bit about where it should be set. We'll be right back. Welcome back in and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys. We have Ryan and Brian from Arlinghouse in with us this morning. And before we get started on the thermostat, give us your contact information, how our listeners can reach you.
Yeah, absolutely. Several different ways that you can reach out to us. You know, the most traditional way would be 859-727-9000. Give us a ring. Both Ohio, Indiana, and Kentucky customers can call that number. We've also got a website, arlinghouseair.com. You can reach out to us on our Facebook page, and we're also on Instagram.
Very nice. And going into the break, I was talking a little bit about our thermostats, and that's an important, even though it was, you know, joking a little bit about Tony having the high dollar one. That's an important part of the house, and that can lead to a lot of problems.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, so it's funny, there was a survey that was done, you know, to homeowners and to ask them what type of system they have. And they said, I have a Honeywell heating and air system, because that's what they see at the thermostat. That's all that they see. So, yeah, as far as what the homeowner is in control of, that's the biggest thing I think homeowners have a grasp on. So,
do people use much of the rotary dial anymore? Those things should be long gone.
The old mercury dial?
Yeah.
We still see them every once in a while, but they're mostly going away.
Right.
Yeah, your digital programmable. Yeah.
I can remember the old boy. It's like, yeah, set that thing about 7 degrees up, and I had to take it right where you need it. You know, they were never, I don't know if they were accurate or not.
Apparently not, but that was the best available. You know.
And that's when you would leave the door wide open, you know, would aggravate my old man. Oh, my gosh.
To no end.
You don't pay that bill.
But let's talk a little bit about thermostats, because a lot of people, and there are some differing thoughts about this. Some people used to think, I'm headed to work, lower it, coming home from work, make sure that it comes on and warms the house up. Some people like to just find a comfort setting. What's the best?
There are many variations, things that you want to try to do. You know, just moving your temperature 2 or 3 degrees during the middle of the day. With certain systems and certain homes, you can save a fair amount of money on your energy consumption. But are you going to sacrifice comfort? Is that worth it? And for some customers, you see an even keel temperature be more applicable for their setting.
So does that, and this is old school thinking, that if it's coming off and on all the time or at different times, it might wear it out. This is what my dad would say. You keep using that all the time, it's just going to go bad. Well, that's not the case these days, is it? The furnace is more efficient, the air conditioning is more efficient, and now the thermostats technology has caught up. For
more accurate.
Yeah.
It's funny, when we change stats out, you might see that you're more comfortable at a different temperature than you were prior, just because the thermostat's more accurate to what the real temperature is in your home.
Ooh, say that again?
So if we take the old dial thermostat, as you were mentioning before, if it's not accurate, if it's off 4 or 5 degrees, you may think that you're comfortable at, let's just say, 72. And the digital goes in, you notice, oh, wow, 74 is actually chilly in here. That's more accurate. So
that's a really good point. I wouldn't have thought about that.
Absolutely.
You know, so the accuracy is important.
If we could ask you a question.
Sure.
What temperature do y'all leave your thermostat set to?
I was going to just ask you guys that same question. I leave mine at 71 year round. Winter, summer.
I got to text my wife to see, because she's in charge of that. But I think it's around 70, but I could be wrong, because, you know, again, we're a little older. So we grew up without air conditioning in the houses that, you know, Lisa grew up on a farm. She's used to having a fan on, and I'm not kidding you. In her room in the middle of winter, a window will be open, and it might be 60 in there, and she's comfortable with that. Downstairs, I like to be a little more comfortable, but I'm guessing probably around 70.
And is that both summer and winter for you guys?
For me, it is. It's 70, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, and you, Ryan knows, he grew up right around the corner from our house, and it's a built in 61, I think. Mm-hmm. And I think we suffer from the something you talked about last time you were here is the upstairs of the house is warmer than the rest of the house or the downstairs. And I think that might be a venting problem.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Now, you know, when we get into variations in temperature on different floors, there's some things that your heating and air contractor, especially Arlinghouse, should be able to help you out with there. We do air balancing in homes when it applies. Sometimes there's just nothing you can do to fix the engineering of the ductwork itself mm-hmm. and the way that it's set up, because some houses were designed for heating. They weren't designed for cooling. And we're also talking about home performance here.
Right. You know, that's a perfect example. The older homes weren't. They were worried just about heating it during the winter, and you let the window open, and that was what you had for spring and summer before air conditioner became so readily available.
Yeah, there's definitely a change in the way that the ductwork is designed. You know, they used to call it the cold air return, and that mm-hmm. was at the floor because that's where the cold air was. Well, now, newer homes that were built in the last 20 years or so, all the returns are no longer in the floor. We're talking about high wall returns, and we just call it the return. It's not the cold air return anymore because, if anything, it's up there to draw the heat off the top of the room and cool the space.
So what was the function of the cold air return?
So for the furnace, so since there wasn't an air conditioner, you know, in a house that has a cold air return in the floor, we were simply just pulling the cold air out of the room and putting the heat back in. That was the only function of it. That was the only thought process was how do we heat this space? They never thought, how do we cool this space? So.
Did you have air conditioning, Ernie, when you were growing up?
No.
No?
No. I was just, when I was listening to him, I was thinking back. Our room was on the second floor. All the, you know, I had two brothers and three sisters. And in our room, there was myself, my brother Cliff, and Kenny. And being in the second floor of an old home, it was always hot as could be. And we had a couple of fans going, but I can remember on the hottest days in the summer, getting out of the bed and laying on the linoleum floor just to try to cool off.
Kind of like a cat or a dog.
I'm not making that up. And anybody that grew up out on that old stretch of 3L, we're all in the same situation.
Oh, yeah.
Have you guys ever been in a house that was like built in the 1800s?
Yeah, a couple of them. Yeah.
So, and so when we think of a house that was, so they didn't have an air conditioner, so they built the structure to cool itself or to feel cool. So, you know, there's this really cool house I can think of. It's out in Independence. It's a customer of ours. They have a geothermal system. And I'm not even kidding you, every single floor is about, it's got 12-foot ceilings in it. And it's so high because we want all that heat to rise to the top of the room where nobody is hanging out. And that leaves the lower part where we hang out at a more comfortable temperature. So the house was literally designed to, so to speak, cool itself.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you kind of see that, you know, we get to go into all kinds of houses and you get to see, you know, what the engineers were thinking about, you know, when they designed this and,
sure.
And how can it be more, you know, efficient in its time. So, you know, after the 70s and the oil crisis, everybody started getting real energy conscious.
Right.
And we started to see a shift in, you know, building performance, and the windows got, you know, better, and the insulation value went up, all of that stuff.
Right.
And so that's where we are today. And that's really where indoor air quality is coming into play. So
when we come back, we'll talk a little bit about that, because it's important, too. A lot of people are concerned about carcinogens in the air. There's all kinds of issues. Allergies seem to be more prevalent these days. We have Brian and Ryan with us from Arlinghouse Heating and Air. We need to pause for a moment. We'll be right back. Welcome back in and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys. We have Brian from Arlinghouse Heating and Air with us, and you can get to their Facebook or their page by going to arlinghouseair.com, and you also have Instagram and Facebook pages as well.
Yeah, we got it.
And the contact number?
859-727-9000 is the main number.
And if you have any issues or any questions, you can give us a call. And we were going to talk a little bit about air quality, which extremely important these days. A lot of people will just, I guess, look over that and not really give any consideration. You'll notice it when you pulled out that filter in your furnace and go, as I mentioned before, all of that's coming through the house.
Yeah.
You know, where does it come from?
You know. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
We had a Facebook question regarding this. The last time you were in, Ryan, you had really honed in on something I think that had generated a little bit of concern among some people, are those plug-ins. Mm-hmm. I never realized that if you have a lot of those throughout the house, that might not be the smartest thing to consider doing.
Right. Like we said last time, you know, even too much of a good thing can be a bad thing.
Agreed.
So, you know, there are some chemicals that are in those things that are off-gassing into the house. And, you know, you're breathing those things. So when you have a lot of them, some people, you know, they want to smell the flowers or the spring breeze or whatever it's called that you're using. And, you know, they end up putting multiple, you know, plugins in a room, and you know that's not a good thing. It's not intended to be in every plug in your house. And so there was a question.
Yeah, Jody Ziegler, she had asked. She mentioned she lives in an older apartment, and she's not able to put in a lot of the things that you were talking about the last time. I guess like air purifiers and all that other good stuff. What are some other options? So that's why I like the Facebook page, because we'll get some of these questions after the fact. And having the opportunity to follow up on this, she was more concerned about those other options to the old plugins.
Absolutely. So when, you know, in this situation, we don't have a lot of ductwork, so we can't add the UV lights or add in upgraded air filtration, things like that to combat that. And people want just something that's mobile or freestanding. They do make those air purifiers that just plug in. Not the best option for a whole house, but if we're dealing with a smaller space like an apartment, then it could work. Something that I've tried and tested that I really like was I got a sample of it from this convention. It was a new Calgon product, and it's basically an odor eater. So it's a little tub or a dish, and you know, I keep I have a dog, and I keep his food in our pantry, and it tends to smell like dog food in there, of course. And so I like to put that thing in there, and you can't smell anything when that's in there. So if the concern, if this customer, if their concern in her apartment was she just wanted it to smell fresh, then they do make some products that can do that.
Yeah, I also want to point out as well, plants, indoor plants become a value in this particular situation. NASA had done a study with the, it was the spider plant, how much it takes out, you know, all the pollutants it takes out of the environment. It's incredible.
That's awesome.
So plants really come into play as well, in addition to what you're talking about. And I know that I was just surprised when you had mentioned about those plugins. I was like, wow. In addition to, like, you know, there's chemicals in the carpet, there's chemicals in some of the furniture, the fabric. There's a lot of indoor, you know, odors or chemicals that are there that we're totally unaware of. Or we're not even thinking about.
Your cleaning products, or if your house is just freshly painted, you want to check with your Sherwin-Williams or whoever your provider is, see if it has a high VOC count in the paint that you're using. You know, if we can ventilate the house or properly filtrate that, you'll have a healthier home.
So what are we looking for in the paint?
Some paint will be marketed as low VOC.
VOC,
so VOC,
okay.
Volatile organic compounds.
Good point.
Huh.
Yep.
So absolutely. Arnie, when you paint, do you consider that?
I've never really gave it any thought. You know, a lot of times if you have to kill a stain or something like that, there's a Kills product that the oil base is really
pretty strong.
And I know when we have to do something like that at the house, the wife will go to the lake.
maybe you ought to whip that out a little more often, huh? You want a weekend with your buddies? At least I'm gonna get the Kills all out.
You gotta get the Kills out. But it, there is a low odor or a latex version of that.
Right.
But you know, a still old school guy, get that oil out. You know, but that's a really good point.
And like you mentioned, plants are great. You know, Boston ferns, aloe vera.
Right.
Plants will have different. You know, collection properties when it comes to carbon
dioxide. Plants really purify the air, and you know, I mean, it's just understood too. I mean, with all the trees and so forth, I mean, they take a lot of the pollutants out of the air, and just the same, not only outside, but inside applies just as well.
Absolutely.
749-B105 in and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys. We have Ryan and Brian with us from Arlinghouse Heating and Air. We're talking a little bit about air quality. We're going to talk a little bit more about that when we come back, and a few other things we're going to touch base on. We'll be right back. Welcome back in and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys. We have Ryan and Brian from Arlinghouse Heating and Air with us. We're talking a little bit about the air quality in your house, and it's important to pay attention to that.
Absolutely.
And so you guys also have a service where you can come out and check it for people.
Yeah. So one of the things that Brian has really led the way on when we got this machine, it's called Air Advice. And this machine takes into account the things that we can't see. So we're sitting here talking about VOCs, volatile organic compounds. You can't see that in the air. Mm-hmm. And so Arlinghouse spent a lot of money on several of these monitors now to where we can actually test, you know, what's in the air, the things that we can't see. And, you know, one of those things is the chemical compounds. The other is the amount of particulate in the air. You know, when you look and you got the sun shining in through a window and you see the little dust particles,
yeah.
You know, those are particulates you can see.
Yeah, and it's just kind of funny you mentioned that, because every once in a while you're sitting around the house and the sun will peek through the window and you look across the room and go, what the heck is all that stuff?
Have you ever swatted at it? You know, you're like, get out of my face.
It moves.
Yeah. It does.
Funny stuff.
So, and you know, it's testing for not only the temperature, the relative humidity in the home. It's also looking for carbon dioxide, which is something that your heating and air contractor has never tested, unless it's an Arlinghouse employee. And then the other would be carbon monoxide. Which is also, you know, one that people are familiar with, especially in the wintertime.
And I do have to brag on you. I just recently had an experience where my mother and father-in-law live right next door to us, and you guys came out and installed their furnace. And I knew that knowing you and your family, I could give them a call or give you a call. Their alarm was going off.
Yeah.
And you were very kind and taking your time and saying, well, let's just check a couple of things. And you went down through a list, and sure enough, one of the little burners on the gas stove was just cracked open enough, and that alarm probably caused or saved a tragic incident from occurring.
Absolutely. You know, and you know, most of the time, it's not the furnace that is causing it, but usually people are calling their heating and air contractor out when there's a carbon monoxide, you know, alarm that's going off.
What are a couple of things that could cause that?
So, you know, water heaters and gas stoves are probably, you know, the top of the list on this. You know, your furnace actually has a bunch of safety switches in it that will prevent it from doing something tragic. Not to say that it can't happen, because anything is possible,
right,
especially if it's not installed properly. But assuming that it is installed properly, the manufacturer puts some things in there to prevent it. The water heater, you know, there's nothing in the water heater safety switch wise, at least on anything that's not a power vent water heater, to keep it. Let's say a squirrel gets down in the flue and blocks it. You know, it can vent right into your basement. And then your gas oven, it's supposed to. It's designed to vent into the house.
Right.
So we actually had a customer who, you know, that it was going off every time that they cooked. And we installed a low-level detector, just like the one we installed there at Mammy and Pappy's.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the best carbon monoxide detector on the market. And, you know, you had a low alarm that was going off, right, and it let you know. And so they had that. And they just wanted the carbon monoxide detector removed from their home. and it was something that I could have fixed for them very easily on their stove.
So those are people just like to live dangerously.
Living,
you
know, on the edge.
Sometimes you can't help those out. So technology is really a wonderful thing. Tell us a little bit more about some of the advances that you guys have.
Yeah, I think one of the big things that you know, Brian and the rest of the team and myself are doing is, you know, combustion analyzers is one tool that the technician makes the investment on his own. It's part of his tool list, and it's something that we can use on gas furnaces to really fine tune a gas furnace. So a combustion analyzer actually takes a reading from inside the exhaust pipe, and it tests for the carbon monoxide levels and some other parameters so that we can really dial it in. If your furnace is supposed to be 96% efficient, then we want to make sure it is.
Sure.
Right? So.
Yep. 749 B105 and in around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys. And you can get to Arling House's page. It's arlinghouseair.com. We need to pause for just a moment. What are we going to talk about when we come back? What do you want to touch on?
You know, I think some homeowners are really stuck with deciding on new equipment. And so maybe we should give them some pointers on that.
Agreed. We'll be right back. Welcome back in and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys. We have Brian and Ryan from Arling House Heating and Air with us. You can go to their site at arlinghouseair.com. Check them out on Facebook and on Instagram.
That's H-A-U-S.
H-A-U-S. So, and we've been talking a lot about a couple of things to be aware of in your house, but let me ask you, how does a homeowner know whether or not they need new equipment?
You know, it could be a costly breakdown, or it could just be the age of the equipment. If you've got a piece of equipment, you know, in our area, in our part of the world, you know, an air conditioner, the average life is about 15 years. If you get to 20 on that, it's definitely time to start poking around and looking.
You have pushed that envelope far enough.
I got one better for you. The same air conditioning unit is still in my parents' home today that was there when I was a junior in high school.
Yeah.
And it's cold as all get out. So my dad has exceeded his life expectancy on that condenser, has he not?
He must
have. Absolutely.
And he was talking about that the other day. I said, don't say those things.
Yeah.
That's when it happens.
Yeah, you know, the air conditioner is never going to break when it's 65 or 70 degrees out. I can guarantee you that. All right? It's not going to happen.
Yeah.
It's going to be 85, 90, 95 degrees. It's going to go down.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody panics.
And you're so right, and I will compliment you guys on this at Arling House Heating and Air. Ours went out when it was supposed to go out, right in the middle of summer,
mm-hmm.
and you made sure that we had something to accommodate or some comfort level. You know, while Tina and I had to wait a couple of days until you were able to get the unit and get everything there and installed, but that made a huge difference. And that unit worked so well upstairs, it vented right out the window.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things that we've been doing for a couple of years now, everybody panics, but, you know, you are literally making a decision to put something in your house that's going to stay there for hopefully another 15 or 20 years, right? Mm-hmm. And if you make the wrong decision and, you know, you hire a contractor that, oh, it was a great price. It was too good to be true. You
yeah.
know?
Boy, did I get a deal.
Right. If you underpay, you're going to end up overpaying in the long run. So, and you rush into a decision. So, you know, one of the things that we're doing for our customers is we're trying to keep you comfortable while you're waiting on our schedule, because it can get backed up 1, 2, 3 weeks where people are waiting on an air conditioner. So we're going to try and keep you comfortable, as best we can.
749 B105 in and around the house with Tony and Ernie. We have Brian and Ryan in with us from Arling House. And, there's got to be a couple of quick tips you can offer a homeowner to run down to assess whether or not they need new equipment.
If you're noticing that the house is not even, mm-hmm. you're seeing a big disparity between your main floor, your upstairs, it's just running forever. It seems like it never shuts off.
Mm-hmm.
If you're noticing high humidity in the home, it's just uncomfortable, just give us a call. We can come out and take a look at that.
Now, Brian, you mentioned something when we were in the break that I think is an excellent service and one of those Good Samaritan things. If you are about to move into a new house, tell me a little bit about that.
Absolutely. There are some neighborhoods we have distributed a flyer to. Mm-hmm. If you're new to the neighborhood, you're unfamiliar with who to trust, who are your service providers, give us a call. We'll mm-hmm. come out and take a look at your home. We'll walk you through the home itself, the system, show you how it works, give you the age, let you know more about the system that you have in your new home.
So that leads me to this next thing is you mentioned trust in the comment you just had. That's got to weigh heavy on a lot of homeowners because, in all honesty, homeowners are looking at heating and air conditioning as one of those things that It's wonderful until it goes wrong, just like you and Tony were talking about it. And then they panic, and they don't know who to trust.
Yeah, I think that element of integrity, or, you know, people not having to feel obligated. And we were talking about, too, getting second opinions, or you guys coming out and giving free, you know, estimates and so forth, or walking a new homeowner through their system, you know, without any obligation. I mean, you know what you have. It's almost like when we talk about soil samples a lot of times, Ernie. You know, knowing what you have to build upon, I think it's a great service that you guys provide. That's awesome. You know, it's just,
thank you.
You know, feeling comfortable with a local family-owned business like Arling House, I think there's a lot to be said for that. And even Brian, the owner, says, get a second opinion. Even if you go and give someone an estimate, he even encourages them, get a second opinion. You know, that says a lot about your company.
Heating and air, I mean, it's expensive stuff, okay? I don't want to scare anybody, but it is. So, you know, in any instance where you're looking at a high repair bill, somebody's recommending maybe a compressor needs to be changed, a heat exchanger that's failed or has a crack in it, or, you know, they're recommending a new piece of equipment, just get a second opinion. It's not a big deal. Just
it's a little like taking your car to the garage and a guy comes out and says, I think you need more turn signal fluid. That's going to be it's going to be $100. You know.
Sounds like that happened to you.
It did. 749-B105 in and around the house. Let's sort of touch a base on a couple of other things. Let's back up just a little bit. Tell me about what a homeowner should look for when it comes to, last time you were here, we were talking about their air conditioner outside. A lot of people try to hide them.
They do, yeah. So, you know, they want to hide it with a bush of some sort, some decorative grass. You really want to keep some clearance around that air conditioner, about 12 to 18 inches all the way around the air conditioner. You don't want to put anything over top of it, like a deck or anything like that. I mean, literally, if you put your hand on top of the air conditioner, there's warm air coming out the top of it.
Yeah.
So that's what we're discharging the heat from that we've collected inside, and we're taking it outside where it doesn't matter. So don't put anything over top of it, all right? We had a customer recently that they had a chimney repair, and the masonry company or whomever it was, they covered the air conditioner for like 3 days with a tarp. Because they didn't want anything falling on top of it, right? Well, then the air conditioner broke.
And they wondered why.
They wondered why.
If it's supposed to have air to work and you cut off that air,
would you cover up the radiator on your car and drive 90 miles down the expressway? No, you wouldn't do that. So
I'd rather have the turn signal fluid.
Yes, that's true. Let's also revisit all the carcinogens, all the air quality stuff that needs to be checked. What's the first thing they should look for there?
Proper filtration. Just making sure that your filter media that you're using is pleated, not too thick if it's a 1-inch, and getting fresh air every once in a while. There's nothing wrong with opening up windows or doors and letting in some of that outdoor air.
Yeah, you know, you guys are much, much younger than Tony and I, but there was a time growing up where your mom would do that. It would be like a spring cleaning, and it'd be the first time every window in the house was open. Every door was propped open.
And every fly in the neighborhood was inside, too. So, and that comes along with it as well.
Yeah.
But on the thermostat, you have that fan setting. You know, what's that little button on the side that says auto or on?
Ooh, good point. Tell me about that. Because there's another part of the where I get confused.
For sure. Well, that's going to be your circulating fan. So that's utilizing the fan that's moving the air around your house.
Right.
If upstairs is crazy hot, downstairs is comfortable. If we're running our circulating fan, we're going to keep the house more even. That's our goal.
Okay.
But also when you crack open the windows, you're bringing in some of those allergens. If the fan's running, what are we doing? We're filtering the air. We're keeping the air cleaner.
Gotcha. 749-B105 in and around the house. And Tony mentioned that there are thermostats available that will alert you when to change that filter.
Yeah, we can get that all set up for you. We got a lot of options on thermostats.
And I also remember, though, a couple of times ago when you were here, you have a setting on your phone where you can stay in contact with your house and your machine or your furnace or air conditioner. And I don't know if your Fiance,
yeah,
is aware, but he said, I can change the thermostat right now and either make it colder in the house or make it warmer in the house. And
she'll be the first caller.
She'll be the first one to go. You better check this out.
Yeah, it's like the remote for the TV, right? Now it's on, you know, your heating and air system is on your phone. Mm-hmm. That's the remote for your heating and air system. Pretty awesome stuff.
Yeah. You know, Ryan, do you guys have any specials going on right now that might be of some interest to some homeowners? And I know you guys also offer financing for people that might make it a little easier if, in fact, hey, we're in the middle of summer and they need to change something out.
Absolutely. Yeah, we've got some 0% interest options when you're looking at, you know, your equipment replacement. There's some special rebates that are out there that we can educate you on, and we want to make sure that we maximize that for you and get you every dollar back that we can from the tax man. So, yeah, there's definitely some offers that are out there in regards to replacing your system. So.
Always great spending time with you, Ryan. Brian, very nice to meet you.
Yes,
please
sir.
Come back and join us, Brian and Ryan from Arling House Heating and Air. And before we slip out today, give us your contact information one more time.
It's 859-727-9000. You can go to arlinghouseair.com. You can reach out to us on Facebook, and we're also on Instagram.
In and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys. You guys have a great weekend. We'll be back next Saturday morning.